Welcome to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. In this episode of Regenerative Mindset, I sit down with William Peters, a psychotherapist, best-selling author, and visionary founder of the Shared Crossing Project. As a global leader in shared death studies, William's mission is to transform our understanding of death and dying, illuminating extraordinary end-of-life experiences and their profound healing potential. William shares insights from his groundbreaking work, including near-death experiences like my own, and shared death experiences like I recently prepared for with my own mother as she passed. Together, we explore how these encounters with the other side reveal death not as an ending, but as a transition filled with love, connection, and meaning. He offers practical advice on preparing for the end of life, fostering open conversations about this most important passage, and integrating spiritually transformative experiences into daily life. Drawing from his book, At Heaven's Door, and his upcoming documentary, William illuminates how profound encounters can guide personal growth and healing. Join me for this profound discussion about the transformative power of shared death experiences and the lessons they offer with William Peters. Hi, William. Good to see you. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, there's so much I want to talk about because I've known you probably about 10 years. I took your Beyond Death and Dying, I don't remember the title of it, like in 2014, something like that, I think. That was when we met, and it was a whole course on death and dying. That was really mind-opening, eye-opening, incredible for me. And then since, you and I have had occasion to interact for other reasons, one being my own near-death experience, and you really helped me really make sense of it and understand the qualities there, but even more recently with my own mom's passing. We did a shared death meditation. And you're just going to help me language and understand all of this as we unpack. So what I want to start with is, how did you become this expert in death and dying? Can you give us a little brief history, or as long as you want to take?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, you know, when I think of being in high school and college, you know, I'm always looking at what my career or work's going to be. And I never thought that I would end up, you know, some 30, 40 years later, studying death and dying, end of life, and pretty much more than anything else, I study the spiritual aspects of death and dying. But I did have an experience when I was 17 years old during a high-speed skiing accident. I crushed my low spine, and I was catapulted out of my body. And I sailed away from my body, looked down at beautiful planet Earth, and, you know, went through this tunnel and came to the light, and I realized that I was dying. And I pled with that light to come back. I mean, I grew up Catholic, so I said to that light, I need to go back. Like, I didn't complete what I came into this life to do. I don't even know why I had that knowledge of insight, but I said it just like that. I didn't complete what I came into this incarnation to do. But, you know, when I got into the light, it was so loving, so comforting. I remember myself saying, you know what? I don't need to go back. I'm good. It's so divine. I mean, it's sublime. The feelings, we don't really have that type of experience here in the human world, I don't think. And I think for those of us who've had certain types of near-death experiences, which that was a near-death experience, they're ineffable. So I had that experience and I came back, you know, I was only 17 years old and I didn't even think about that experience at all. But I'd have another near-death experience when I was 30 years old. I contracted a blood disease, idiopathic thrombocytopenia. It's a rare hemophiliac type condition. And I ended up in the ICU. And once again, I was out of my body, this time very close to my body, looking at my body in the ICU, moving around that whole hospital ceiling level, listening to conversations, very comfortable, like I was able to do this all the time, although I can't remember another time I've done that. So I had these two experiences. And I should say, in the interim, between my first NDE on the ski slope and that second one, I had been transformed in a certain way that I'm not so sure what happened, but I did have chronic pain with my back injury. I had to recover from that. But I changed in terms of what was important to me. And I found myself living and working in Central and South America in the late 80s. And there were two civil wars going on and a lot of death happening. And at the same time, I was working with indigenous peoples and they had a very different view about what happens at the time of death. You know, they have ancestors and they believe, you know, that after you die, you go in to be with the ancestors. So a lot of things were kind of coalescing to stretch me into this interest or curiosity at first into what happens around death and dying. I mean, I had came back from Central America and actually worked in the Tenderloin of San Francisco during the AIDS epidemic. I was hired because I was fluent in Spanish, but the AIDS epidemic broke out and all of a sudden I find myself at the bedside of, you know, dozens and dozens of primarily, you know, young gay men dying of AIDS. And I'm hearing these experiences that now I study, you know, these spiritual experiences where people feel like they're accompanying their departing loved ones on this journey out of the human body into an afterlife. So that's really how I got into it. I don't feel like I chose any of this. It just kind of happened that this was it. And then as I matured as a psychotherapist, I realized kind of surprisingly that I was very comfortable with death and dying. And others were not. And even my own colleagues, generally speaking, are very uncomfortable with death. I laugh, but I get tons of referrals from colleagues in psychotherapy because this is a case for you, you know. So I found myself working really with people facing end of life, death and dying, whether it's a terminal diagnosis with cancer or, you know, or someone who's tragically just lost a loved one for whatever reason. And sadly, you know, we're in an era where sudden deaths are happening, you know, with some increase because of the fentanyl situation. You know, I may be biased because I get these cases, but I've never seen a time when, well, the last few years have been filled with this. I think we're actually getting a handle on it now. But this being said, this is how I got into it. And I remain very interested in these experiences of end of life. And I'm particularly interested in these spiritual experiences. And so I set up the Share Crossing Project, first to teach people about what actually does happen at the time of death and dying. And you were in that Life Beyond Death course and that we ran from 2012 to 2016, 2017. And then we started a research initiative to document these transformative, healing spiritual experiences at the end of life. We call them shared crossings, and a particular type of experience is the shared death experience where caregivers and loved ones report that they accompany their dying loved ones into the initial stages of the afterlife. And they see that they're greeted by departed loved ones, or there's a guide there that shows up to assist them. And there's beautiful light and heavenly realms. And it's very similar to the near-death experience, except that as caregivers, loved ones, we're not having the brush with death. We're accompanying or observing one of our loved ones in that journey.
Right. And so that shared death experience process, which you use SDE for short, it would seem, having done it with my mom, I mean, one has to be semi-comfortable with death oneself, because the process, it surprised me. I didn't know what it was going to be, but I was at my own deathbed. Those that were sitting with my mom, we each had, it surprised me. It's like, okay, I'm going into the death and dying process. And so someone would need to be fairly comfortable with that process.
Absolutely. You said it really well, is that part of when I assist people, as I did with your family, in, you know, hopefully enabling or facilitating a shared death experience, part of that training, if you will, is bringing everybody together to a realization that we're all going to die, mm-hmm. and that this is a natural part of life. In fact, it's the only thing we know is going to happen in life, is that we're going to die at some point.
Death and taxes is actually true.
It's so true. So, but yes, you identified the important step is that, and I mean, I think, you know, we talked about this, you really got in your heart and mind like, oh, well, my mom is coming to this point of transition of human death. But in doing the exercises we did, you were like, oh my gosh, I know this is going to happen to me and everyone I love. And that opens the heart and mind with a level of consciousness about this. It's kind of an enlightenment experience, like, aha, it's like, oh, this is happening for one of us now. It's my mother, but I'm going to be present to this. And everyone in your family was, and it was so beautiful. And we know that that actually, that open-heartedness, if you will, enables these spiritual experiences. There's not the holding of your mind in a certain way. You're not, you know, restricting yourself. You're breathing fully into this reality that in this case, your mother is dying and she's dying now.
Well, in particular, I mean, I've had a number of different experiences, whether they be a dream I had, a couple of dreams I've had, or my own near-death experience. I've had a couple of experiences that I think enable me to have a little bit more ease. But what I thought was such a gift too was my dad at 97, you know, he's able to have language. You really facilitated language for him. You asked him beautiful open-ended questions about what do you feel happens after we die. He had an answer that I didn't know he had. And he was very clear about it. And you were able to give him the security to know that his beloved of 69 years this Sunday was going to go on ahead of him, that he was going to be joining. So this idea of we're not separating, we're not alone in this bigger holistic project called life and death, I feel that was one of the more healing, you know, one of the healing aspects of what you're doing.
One of the things that I have to do when I'm working with families is, you know, I know you, I know Ron, you know, and I know a bit about your family, but I didn't know what your father and your mother, I didn't know their view of what happens at the end of life. So I did, you know, just start by inquiring, yeah, directly, which we don't do this in our culture. We don't have a conversation about, well, what do you think is going to happen to your beloved of 69 years? And, you know, as you said, he was so clear. She's going to go to heaven and Jesus is going to meet her there and it's all going to be fine. And he was very clear about that. And so, you know, okay, we just work with that and kind of evolve as I did in the moment. Kind of a larger landscape that includes, very much includes what he already expects, but we put some more pieces in it, if you will, a bit more of a roadmap and a guided visualization. This is how you leave your body. You know, you're going to release, you're going to feel lighter. You're going to have a sense of liberation and expansion. And, you know, we were doing that together. So everybody was doing that. I don't know if you noticed this, but your mother, I was doing that guided visualization. She was moving like she was registering that. And you could see her eyes flicker a little bit, not open in a certain way. She didn't open until later. That was really quite beautiful when she did open her eyes. She opened right after the guided visualization. But the point being is she was listening. And we know this because the last sense door that, you know, goes offline in death is hearing. So we always assume when we're working with people at the end of life, when we're working with the dying, that they're hearing us, even though they may be unresponsive, as your mother was.
I was so grateful that you reminded me of that, because those that came to visit, or if we did phone calls, FaceTime, people were able to actually really be complete with it, knowing that she could hear and that there was that connection. But hearing what you're saying now makes me want to ask you to name. There are known stages of death and dying because enough people have come back from that state. So could you name what those are, just so that we could hear what's been known about this?
Yeah. So most of what I'm going to share with you comes out of near-death experience research, the shared death experience research. And I will bring in a little bit of what we know from past life regressions, when they literally will work with people on past lives, and they'll go to the end of a life and say, tell me what happened when you died. How did you die? And what did you experience? And I would only be sharing this with you if it was relevant, because everything corroborates. It's all the same. Like, there's no real difference here. So what tends to happen is a person will release from their body. So in other words, there's that moment. And this is the most jarring part, is that the dying lets go, or there are some deaths that are traumatic and they don't choose to let go. They're forced out of their body. And that has trauma in it that is worked out on the other side, actually. So there's this release. And from everything we can tell, there are a few different experiences. So sometimes the most common is this sense of, oh, I'm still here. And they have a view. They're oriented towards the human realm or the earth realm. And they're looking back down at and seeing their family members. And then apparently their view can go, the mind can go wherever. So they can move across the earth and come to people. Like, time and space doesn't seem to matter. We know this because about 2/3 of all of these shared death experiences are remote. In other words, somebody in New York will say, hey, at like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I was just sitting at my computer and all of a sudden I felt my mom. And then I felt this sense of her saying, I'm okay. I started to weep. My mom was coming to me to say that she was okay. And then she said, I love you. And I felt that. And I said, well, I love you too. But they don't know how to contextualize it, because our culture doesn't have that contextualization. But then they realize when they get a call 20 minutes, half an hour later, hey, just wanted to tell you that your mother died. They put it together, go, wait a minute, when? Oh, about 20 minutes ago. Really? So, you know, it sounds kind of bizarre that we're talking about this in the way that we are, because where I sit as an end of life, you know, death and dying researcher, I have hundreds of these accounts. I mean, I can't process all of them. I have a team of 14 researchers and we have more than we could ever process. It's that common, but we still don't talk about it because in our culture, it's weird. And you don't want to be that person who says, you know, like they look at you like, well, you know, Steve's mother died and he just hasn't really been the same. He's just, something's gone off with him. No one wants that to be perceived as crazy and losing it. So I'm just giving you examples. This is how we know that when someone dies, they drop their body, they enter into this post-mortem reality. Time and space doesn't matter. If they're looking back at planet Earth, they actually have the capacity to go visit people, which we hear of all the time. But we don't know how common that is versus another experience, which is somebody dies and they're confused. They don't know what's going on. And sometimes we have in our shared death experience in our research, we have caregivers, loved ones say, well, suddenly I found myself with my father and he was confused. And I said, Dad, are you okay? He goes, well, I don't know. He says, well, you've died. You mean I died? What do you mean? It's like, yeah, you died. Remember? And they literally have some sort of cognitive dissonance. Like they don't understand where they are. But in the shared death experience, in these cases, we know that the caregiver loved one who's now in the initial stages of the afterlife with, in this case, the father dying, says, Dad, I'm going to help you. Turn around and I want you to move towards the light. Now, at this point, we now are going to move through the features and phenomena that we have studied and others have studied that seem to be available to the dying in their transition. So the first one is encounters with predeceased loved ones. So there's a greeting party. Oftentimes, loved ones who have predeceased are there to greet them. Sometimes there's a spirit guide there, an elevated being. And sometimes that being is what I call the conductor, who has this role of kind of managing the transition of this person. And the conductor has a very purposeful personality. They're very intentional. They're kind of businesslike. You get a sense they have a job to do. And they command authority. They're kind, but they've got a job to do, and it's to move these now spirit beings out of their human body through the stages of the afterlife. And they tend to be doing ascension. They tend to be going up. They tend to be moving towards the light. There tends to be heavenly realms, beautiful landscapes around. But all of these become kind of the landmarks of the afterlife, you know, the initial stages. And it's corroborated in near-death experience narratives, shared death experience narratives, and now in the past life review data as well. Those narratives of which, you know, Michael Newton Institute has, he had 10,000 more than a decade ago. He's no longer alive, but the Institute continues and they continue to document. So yeah, I hope that's a long-winded answer for the landscape in the afterlife, but I think it makes sense.
Well, I think it's important because what I recall is that you had shared that the consistency of reporting is extremely high. So statistically, I remember in the class, and I don't know if you remember it, but you had said something about the FDA approves drugs with, you know, a 12%, you know, validity. But these experiences have like a 90-something percent similarity validity, and yet we don't accept it. And what I was thinking is, you say we don't have the ability to understand, let's say, non-locality, but we do. I mean, quantum physics has been on the cover of, you know, Scientific American for decades. It's like, guess what? You know, quantum physics is real, and we just can't get it. We just don't want to get it. So I think it is explained in science in some ways. It is definitely explained culturally in some indigenous cultures, but because we can't explain it with Newtonian physics, I don't know. What would you say there?
No, I think you're correct. For one, those who are responsible for managing death and dying experiences in modern cultures are, you know, modern medicine, healthcare, allopathic medicine, and they are based in the scientific method. You know, this is more fiscalist type scientific approaches, and they demand cause and effect and visual, demonstrable, replicable experiments, you know, to be proven. So what we're talking about at the moment of death is the unseen world. We don't have any way to measure what goes on in the spirit realm. So there's a great deal of resistance to accepting these anecdotal accounts because they tend to refer to them as, you know, wishful thinking or hallucinations or grief-induced hallucinations. But really what it is that they have a view. They've grown up with that view. It's very material. You know, if you're in the healthcare system, you deal with material. You deal with the human body and you see it as it's mechanized. I mean, the medical sciences, without any real literature on this and any research, still purports that the brain creates consciousness. And although there is no study that can support that, they still will say, in fact, you know, I have, you know, colleagues who are doctors and say, oh yeah, we all have, you know, like a page or two on consciousness. And it says that the brain creates consciousness. So when the human body dies, brain waves stop, heart stops, consciousness stops. And that's it. And that is, you know, that would be a form of kind of atheism, you know, kind of the sense of that's it. There's nothing more. Everything's done.
But it's a guess, though, at best, because we don't, what you're saying is we don't have proof of that. So really, it's still a guess.
That's what they live with as normative. And, you know, I mean, I have colleagues who are MDs, and they will say it is not efficacious for your reputation or in your career, professional career as a medical doctor, to, you know, assert that human consciousness survives human death. That's just kind of creating a glass ceiling for yourself. They say it's just not respected.
You'll go into, yeah, a small box of, you know, create the name. I mean, New Age would be the nicest one, but wacko.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, as you know, we live in one of the more liberal, open-minded parts of modern medicine here in, you know, the West Coast of the United States. And even here, it's frowned upon, those types of views. And you're right. There does exist in the, you know, the cutting edges of quantum physics and fifth dimension physics, there is this sense that is kind of interesting that we go on because we're energetic beings. You know, it's like the first law of thermodynamics. Energy can never be created or destroyed. It can only be transmuted or transformed into another representation, but it goes on. And yet, because they can't explain how that happens in a human death, they kind of let that go. But I always found that, like, that seems to be the most obvious definition or description of what happens at human death, is that your energy is transformed into something else or transmuted into something else. But once again, modern sciences aren't open to that. But, you know, and I should say, I do think there's a softening around this. The level of which I think the step we're seeing now is more honoring the mystery rather than, I think, what was, you know, traditionally really kind of brazen, hardcore, no nonsense canon that at human death, consciousness ends. Because the brain's the creator of consciousness.
Well, keeping the notion of mystery, I mean, there's a few concepts that you've mentioned. You've talked about these are spiritual experiences, which is interesting as a category. And can we, in fact, have spiritual experiences? And it depends on how, you know, what path we follow as to whether we are enabled as humans or if that's the job of the divine. I don't know. And so that's one of my questions is, does one's religious belief have to align with anything in order for them to participate in something like a shared death experience or to understand this work?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, in all of our interviews, we've done, you know, many hundreds of interviews with experiencers, and we always ask them, what's your religious upbringing? And we hear all sorts of religious upbringings, you know, Southern Baptists and, you know, Christians of all denominations. Most of our experiencers are, you know, from North America or Europe. So Christianity or Judeo-Christianity is where most of our people come from. Although we are making a huge effort to get out to other cultures around the world. It's just difficult. But we don't see how any particular religious spiritual upbringing yields these spiritual experiences. What is interesting is, I would say this, an open-mindedness. So your relationship to your religious spiritual beliefs, if you're open-minded, and also if you can be receptive to death as a natural part of life, I think those all create the environment in your mind, if you will, to have a shared death experience. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. I worked at Zen Hospice for, you know, as a hospice volunteer, I'm now about 25 years ago, for a number of years. And I was having these experiences. But even, you know, there at Zen Hospice, we were always taught to be present, to, you know, be mindful of what's coming up for you as you're sitting with somebody. And you would think that that practice would avail yourself to have these shared death experiences. But when I brought up one of my experiences, I didn't go anywhere. Like, people was like, oh, And so I realized that I wasn't going to be able to share them there. So it's kind of interesting. It's perplexing, quite frankly. But I do have a bit of a theory about that. And I do think it's that a lot of Buddhist practices, mindfulness practices, are about noting. So you kind of note phenomena and then you can kind of let it go. So in that letting go process, it's a bit dismissive. So perhaps that's the reason why people who are very open-minded and heart-opened and present with the dying may not nurture a shared death experience when it happens. And so they miss it. But I can't say for sure.
Well, what I'm aware of is how, just in my own casual, you know, discussions, like when there's a discussion of someone dying, death and dying, it's that much more common, but just not discussed phenomenon. Like, more people, like a cousin or a neighbor, well, you know, when my dad died, I was sitting at bedside and I saw something fly out the window. I can't say, but more people have a story that they just either forgot about, they dismissed. Even like my mom, you know, I was telling you that a few days after my mom passed, I was in a Tai Chi class. She was right there doing Tai Chi with me. And it didn't even occur to me that that was a nameable experience. And you've got a name for that. Like, she was clear as day. She looked great. She was actually better at Tai Chi than she was while she was living. But but she was wearing something that, you know, I recognized. And it was her. And what did you call that?
Well, that would be a post-death visitation by your mother. In other words, she came into the space where you were as a spirit being, but you were able to see her. And you said, I believe, that she looked healthy, right?
She looked great. And so what distinguishes a post-death visitation from a fantasy? Like, I wasn't sitting there trying to imagine my mother. It came to me. It had a quality of realness. I mean, it was persistent. And I kept kind of like shaking my head going, wait, what's happening here? I don't know. It was in my mind's eye. I don't know if my eyes were closed, but what are the qualities that distinguish a fantasy or hallucination from a visitation?
Great question. Let's do a distinction between dreams and visions or visitations. So first of all, anybody that has an experience that we're talking about at night while they're in a sleep state will call it a dream, because that's what we culturally attribute to those types of phenomena when we're in a sleep state. We call it a dream. And if you have it during the day and you're daydreaming, then that's what we do. That's our culture's way for capturing these experiences. We call them dreams. But the truth of the matter is that these experiences, whenever they happen, day or night, are visions or visitations. And why? Well, for one, dreams, by their very nature, tend to be symbolic. They tend to be distorted. They tend to have, if you can imagine, you know, people from your childhood you haven't seen in, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, and they're flying, or, you know, they're with other people they wouldn't normally be with. Things are distorted, you know, and they're often fragmentary. So this is because dreams are symbolic, and the distortions serve from the unconscious to get your attention in a certain way. Well, visions or visitations are not like that. They're more real than real. So when you see somebody in a vision or visitation, they will typically look younger. They'll look healthy. They will have on clothes that you recognize. And they come almost with a particular intention. You may not know the intention until after the vision, but typically the intention is something like, you see, I'm alive and well. or I love you, or I've made it to the other side and I'm good. Whatever it is, that's the fundamental difference. It's like these visions, visitations are authentic experiences without distortion, with specific purpose, and the people present as they were in their life, usually the best time of their life, typically, from what we can tell. Maybe spirits are vain in the afterlife.
Or maybe they know we're vain and we want to see things looking good.
Yeah, exactly. Could be that too. But that's how we distinguish. It's a pretty clear-cut distinction. And I don't think anyone in the field who studies these would disagree with what I just said. It's a differentiating process is not very difficult once you've worked with a few hundred of these.
Okay, so my dad was there, you know, physically nearby after that visitation I had, and I told him about it. And that upset him. And he said, oh, that I don't want to hear about that right now. And I'm like, okay. I said, but I experience her as present, Dad. And he's like, what do you mean? I'm like, I just feel her energy here. And then all of a sudden, a big rainbow appears. And I go, oh, look, Mom's showing us what she can do. And he really liked that. So the fact of there being signs, I know signs are part of your work or this whole realm of work. And I know a lot of people, it's like whenever I see a bluebird, it's my mom. One of my girlfriends has that. Another one, dragonflies. Or another one is a certain kind of phenomenon happen. I know it's my dad saying hello. So tell me a little bit about that.
So what you're referring to is synchronicity. Post-death synchronicities. We also have at-death synchronicities. We even have pre-death synchronicities. But the most common is post-death synchronicities. And, you know, I have to say, as a researcher in this, I was really reluctant to study these because this feels so new agey and flimsy research, you know. But we have so many accounts. I mean, I want to say we have well over 1,000 synchronicity accounts, and they are often, they come in different forms. One of the more common forms is electrical, things that are influenced by electricity. So somebody dies and people will report that, that's so funny, all of the clocks, the digital clocks in the house froze at the time of death. That's weird. Or it's so interesting, that clock has been flashing my mother's now deceased birthday every day since she died. I don't, it just comes on automatically. It just comes on, you know? And so this is the type of thing we see. And at first you're like, come on now, you're kind of, you know, delusionary, but we get too many of these to think that all these people are delusionary. So it's like, yeah, now we track them and it's common, you know, lights flicker as well. When you talk about people, you know, and they say, oh my God, that's mom. Oh my God, that's dad. So the light flickering thing is another one of these. So those are electrical events. The other one that we see a lot of, and you made reference to this, is animal behavior. We have cases where, you know, in February in Kansas, you know, birds show up that shouldn't be there that time of year. Like, wait a minute, what's a cardinal doing here? They don't come out until spring. So it's kind of like it gets your attention. You know, and the one you also brought up, dragonflies and hummingbirds. We see a lot of that. They come close to windows, and they seem to be wanting to get our attention. They're like doing their thing, you know, flying away, coming back, flying away, coming back. They seem to have a purpose until you say, hi, mom, I see you. Thanks for coming. And then that seems to put it away, you know. So you can have communication with these beings in a certain way and these animal behaviors. The one that I have seen that's really compelling is sea life mammalian behavior. So sometimes as I'm doing grief and bereavement counseling with someone, they'll say, you know, I just want a sign from, you know, my mother, my father, my spouse, whatever. And I say, you know, why don't you go for a walk down on Miramar Beach, let's say, because it's a nice beach to walk on. And I can tell you that more than half the time they will come back the next week or two and say, you know, I've got to tell you something. you told me to take that walk. I walked that beach. I've walked that beach, you know, my whole life or forever a period of time. When I asked for a sign, I walked down there. I kind of feel embarrassed telling you this, but all of a sudden, all these dolphins appeared. I was walking down the beach and they're coming with me. And then they put on this show. I'm like, I'm looking around. Is anybody seeing this? You know? And so I've had numerous experiences. In fact, we have a mutual friend, Nancy Kopelman. She had that. And I wasn't able to attend this, but she died around Memorial Day weekend. And then remember, her birthday was the first part of June. And so they gathered for her on her birthday.
I was there.
You were there. Well, tell me what you saw.
Well, there's a lot to say about our friend Nancy. I mean, you could start with her time of death. I believe a number of people had visits.
Yes.
As well as, I know a close friend who is also a close friend of hers. We went for a very early morning visit at Hammond's Beach, where she lived. She had lived. She loved it there. And I believe it was a heron. And its behavior, like it was just right there and it was in a weird position. There was something about it. We were like, that's Nancy. We just knew it was, you know? And then I don't know if it was a week or more. It was her birthday. You're right. It was maybe a week after because her birthday was like the 6th or the 4th or something in June. And a group of us gathered early because she loved to go to the Channel Drive. And we gathered, and as we were singing happy birthday, I think it was, all of a sudden these dolphins started leaping and just putting on a show. It was just ridiculous. And everyone there just was like, that is weird. It was really crazy weird. But Nancy had so many stories.
No, I mean, this is the thing, you know. Nancy was very studied in end of life. She did all of our groups, all the Share Crossing Projects groups, of which you were in as well. But she did all of them. She did them, you know, multiple times. And she just loved hearing about and learning about what's possible around death. And, you know, I had an experience too where I got up in the morning. I got a call early in the morning, like 6 o'clock, saying that Nancy had died. And I went downstairs, you know, as I do every day, and I poured myself a cup of tea and I just said, oh, Nancy. And then all of a sudden, boom, she was right there. Her face was huge, right next to me. And she just had that Nancy expression. Well, to be continued. And she was happy. She was joyous. And what was curious about that experience was that same day, because I believe this was like a Thursday or Friday, Olivia, my daughter, who at the time was maybe 9 years old, and she would go to school every day. I wasn't with her this morning, but her mom was driving her. And Olivia came back at the end of the day, and I said, hey, I got some news for you. And by the way, Olivia and I were visiting Nancy every Sunday for, you know, from like through February, March, April, and then May. You know, we must have visited a dozen times. And Nancy really loved visiting with Olivia because she would say, I know I'm at the end of my life, but it means so much to me to just have somebody here who's at the beginning of their life. And I just feel like it's just so meaningful. And Olivia would ask her questions and it was so natural. While some people are a little bit nervous and tight and constricted, Olivia was completely comfortable with all this. And she'd pull on her cord, you know, and what's this? She goes, oh, that's my oxygen. She goes, you need oxygen now. And she goes, yeah. She goes, oh, what if you didn't have the oxygen? You know, all these really natural conversations are just like disarming. But Olivia came back at the end of school and I said, sweetie, Nancy died this morning. She goes, yeah, I know. On the way to school, she came to me. I said, what do you mean? She goes, yeah, I was sitting in the back seat. I was looking out the window and she came right in and she said, I've died. I'm fine. I love you. And that's it. And Olivia said it so matter of fact. So yes, and you're right. There were so many people, like at least a dozen people through the years have told me that they had this experiences around Nancy's death and that Nancy came to them. But the one you shared that I didn't attend, that's the one I've heard the most of, where they're gathering on Nancy's birthday on Hammond's Beach, and the display of dolphins, I've heard say like no one's ever seen that display before. Like it was more than Marine World.
Right, exactly. It was more like that. And she had such a fun sense about her that it kind of fit. Plus, I think we were singing happy birthday. So yeah. Well, so it really, in terms of research, which, you know, getting a PhD, one learns about research. So, you know, there's different ways to do it. And is it repeatable? Is it consistent? Are there great numbers of them that prove out statistically? It is science in a certain way. It is a type of science. And yet forging that in a culture that is uncomfortable about death and dying would be the challenge. But I want to just revisit again a little bit about my own near-death experience. My own things of note to mention is that when I took that class, which, by the way, Nancy told me to take, and I did, your class on death and dying, and I had missed a class, and so we had a makeup class, and there was three of us in the room, and you went around, has anyone had any interesting dreams or experiences? And I shared a dream, and it turned out it was a shared crossing with my parents, interestingly. And so it was like, oh, I got to have that experience. So that was fun. And then the fact that I got to do it with my mom later was wonderful. But then due to self-medicating, taking an herb, Uva Ursi, that is a liver detox, I was self-medicating in a very depressed state over the loss, not through death, but the loss of my daughter. And I had a liver failure experience. And so I went to ICU, I went to the hospital, and I had an experience of, I saw the doorway, I saw the hallway, I just got this, oh, I see what's happening. And I just knew I was going. And it was all good. This was my experience. Everything was all good. And I just felt sort of, I mean, bliss almost sounds like a high. It was more like that everything makes sense and everything is well. And then I saw from up in the ceiling, so my awareness was in the ceiling, I could look down and I saw my husband and my son walk in the room, eyes red, so sad. And I remember thinking or wanting to communicate, you don't have to be sad. Everything is great. Please don't suffer. I wasn't able to reach them, but that was my communication. And then I saw a nurse who was working at a station, and she said, I'm going to do everything I can. We are going to save this woman. We are going to make this happen. There's some things I can do to help, and I'm going to do them. I mean, it's not all on the up and up, but I'm going to make this happen. And what I felt was, I was kind of behind her and I was supporting her effort. She wanted this. It wasn't like I was partial to staying. I felt really good about, oh, I see what's happening. Okay, got it. So that is part of what my experience was. I was visited by sort of what one would call like an ancient wise Asian man with a beard and robes, who was silent, but was clearly wise and had a lot of authority and wisdom. And he just was very, very present. And so you gave me some information to think about after this happened with me and how to make sense of it and how to understand how my own life might be different post-NDE. And I'm wondering if you would just share with us what some of those commonalities, because I think NDEs are not that uncommon.
No, you're right. I think the research on NDEs is somewhere between like 5 and 10% of the American population will have them. The North American, I should say. All right. So the commonalities in terms of after effects are this realization that human death is kind of an illusion, is that we survive human death and we go on a different form, become spirits. We drop the body and we go on. The NDE tends to deliver that realization. That becomes like empirically clear. I know this happens. The other piece is fear of death ameliorates. You know, it's just, you maybe have fear of dying, like your process of dying, because it's painful. But death itself, no. 90% of respondents in NDE experiencers will say, I have a cessation of fear or an anxiety about death itself. People tend to have a renewed sense of purpose about life. Like all of a sudden they kind of see life through a different lens. It's like, oh, as you said so well, it's like, oh, this is how it's happening. Oh, this is where I am. It's like, oh, okay. Well, once you realize, oh, there is something after life, well, then you realize, well, there's something to human life. So there's kind of a process that can be facilitated where people come back. And this is one thing that, you know, I and other therapists who are familiar with these experiences, we call this an integration experience. And it's very important that people have the types of experiences we're talking about, near-death experiences, shared death experiences, and any spiritually transformative experience engages in a very deliberate, intentional process of integration. And that begins with a sense of learning about the experience you had, like getting information about it, you know, so you kind of validate for yourself the experience did happen. You go over it in your mind a number of times. You deepen into it. You look around. You kind of do a more methodical exploration of what actually happened. And then you tap the lessons from it. Like, what was it trying to teach me? Like, why did I have this? And what am I supposed to learn from it? And then you go and you, I always encourage people to share it with trusted people and then consider sharing it more broadly. Get in touch with your fears about sharing it. Like, what are you afraid people are going to say to you when you do share this experience? And then eventually you really want to get to a state of living your life with that experience informing it. In other words, I ask this question. If you were to live your life from the truth that were delivered to you in your near-death experience, how would your life change? What would you do differently? How would you be living in integrity with your near-death experience or shared death experience? And that's a process. And we now know that integration of these experiences, when they're done kind of naturally, take about 7 years. They're very powerful. And I think we've been able to expedite that with, you know, more trained therapists like myself. You know, like, and I work with people, I say, you know, if you were to do this naturally on your own, kind of just undeliberately, non-deliberately, just let this experience kind of rattle around in your conscious and unconscious, in about 7 years, you'll come into relationship with it. But that is less desirable than taking it on with a trusted person, you know, therapist, spiritual counselor, what have you, and really tap, mine the experience for all its teaching and gifts. And there's a lot in these experiences, as you know. I mean, I just remember with you, if you don't mind me mentioning, we spent a good time talking about that Asian teacher, that wise person. Like, what was that being there to tell you?
Because what was interesting is it was nonverbal. There were not words. And what I came to was the quality of transmission and the reality of the notion of transmission and how big that is and how overlooked it is. Even in education, like ordinary education, why did this math teacher actually create an absolute love for mathematics in me where it had been a real struggle my whole previous time? My high school math teacher took him for 4 years, every class I could get, and mathematics became so meaningful. Something happened. That was a transmission. So I now have something and I now know something and I now love something because of this person. So I believe that was one of the lessons this person, this being brought.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I like the way you're working with this because for each of these experiences we have, first of all, when we have them, they live in a different dimension in a certain way. Like there's more material, if you will, sensorial, intellectual, spiritual, you know, use the adjective you want, that demand a grappling with it, to interpret it, to get to know it, to unwrap it. You know, you really engaged deeply during our time about like, what is it? And transmission was really an important realization. I think you even kind of got that as like, that's what's missing in our culture. We don't have this. We don't have elders, wise people who we can sit at their feet and receive their hard earned wisdom. What you're talking about is a process that takes time. It takes intention. It takes hard work too. And sometimes we get lessons we don't like. One of the things we see all the time in our research around integration is 90% of persons of NDE experiencers, near-death experiencers, 10 years later, they will not be with the partner that they were with, if they had one, at the time of their near-death experience. It's that pronounced.
And for the reason, 90% 10 years later, okay, I'm 5 years in, let's see how this goes.
I'm not concerned about you because you have such a wonderful, open-hearted, wise partner. But for a lot of people, they have this experience and they have no context. You know, you're a spiritual person, Ron's a spiritual person, and you study things. You have a way of being that's inherently open-minded. But for some people, it's like this stops them in their tracks. Like, I remember working with a man who had a car accident and had a near-death experience. And his wife was at his bedside in the hospital while I was recovering. And he said, you know, I had this experience. Even when I came back in to my body, all I could think about as my body was mending is, where was I? What was this experience where I saw my father tell me it's not my time? Where I saw this beautiful light in the distance, where I felt the most sublime loving feelings, when I realized that I wasn't living the life I was supposed to live. I wasn't living in integrity, like I was making business decisions that made me money, but they weren't altogether honest. And, you know, and his wife was a part of his whole life. They had a whole life together. And he came back and literally after a long recovery, he came to see me and he said to me, he says, I'm really worried. And I said, what? It was so good. He came and said, I'm really worried. That's what he said. And I said, tell me. He says, if I live from what I learned in that NDE, I don't think I can be with my partner anymore. I have to change my work. And half the friends I have, more than half, they can't relate to me anymore. And if I go down that path, that means my children, I'm going to create so much stress in their life because I don't want this. But if I don't honor this, then I'm going to live a lie. This is not uncommon. If you go to these, you know, International Association of Near-Death Studies has an annual conference, and I've been a presenter there every year for, you know, a decade or more. And one of the beautiful things that I observe there and I participated in is you are with your people in a certain way because you can go there and you can say, like, not just about your phenomena of the experience. The narratives are beautiful and inspiring and awe-inspiring. But the things you really get support around is, you know, I had to change my job and I make a lot less money now, but I am happy. And I have intuitive gifts now that I didn't have before. You get people come back with intuitive gifts. I remember your intuitive gifts, which you already had, got increased, if I remember, Stacey. I think that's true, right?
It is, yeah.
So these are big changes. You know, if you were just living a typical modern American life where you have a job, you come back, you love your wife, you watch television, you have your friends come over. Well, once you have this experience, you're like, really? That's what I'm going to do with the next 30, 40 years of my life? I don't think so.
Also, this notion of I fell madly in love with, I already had a deep connection to the land I lived on, but I found this profound connection, like deep. And it has, it really, I believe, sent me into the path I'm in now, which is this regenerative farming. And I can see that there are systems, ecosystems that are pervasive in all aspects, which is why regenerative mindset. And my fantasy is that accepting and understanding and being with, integrating the notions that you're talking about with death and dying create a more holistic, integrated and therefore sustainable philosophy of life.
I'm so glad you're saying that, because a lot of experiencers will say that after this experience, they need to be in nature. They need to go and feel the pulse, the heartbeat of the raw natural world. And it resonates with them deeper than it did previously. I know that for myself. You know, it's this sense, because then you start seeing things, you know, like, you know, in the early part of when I was, you know, really taking on my experiences in death and dying, I remember going out on a hike and, you know, and just looking around and asking this question. It's just like, it just came up naturally. It goes like, what here that I'm looking at isn't going to die? And I remember going through, looking at the trees, looking at the squirrels running around, looking at the wild daisies, looking at everything there. And then I realized something. Oh my God, I was looking at a tree and there was bark kind of about to fall off. And I said, wait a minute. Everything's in a process of dying. Everything's growing, evolving, and dying is a part of it. I remember crying, just going, oh my gosh. It's just like, here it is. You know, you look down, you all of a sudden I saw like some fur of some wild animal. And I go, oh, that wild animal looks like it might've been eaten, you know, cause there's some fur and, you know, that doesn't look like the way that fur comes off, you know? So it's like you are drawn to getting to what life really is.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you live as closely to it so you can feel the essence of life? And, you know, words are hard to capture this, but when you live in that stream of honoring life and the changes of seasons and death and rebirth, it's a different way of being in the world.
Well, it feels to me a meaningful sense, not feeling alone. And, you know, because it increases the levels of communication. From my experience, I have many more types of communication so that the world is more animated, or, you know, I might even say I love the word enchanted, because I feel communication in so many levels, because many beings that don't have words like we do still communicate. And it just forces, you know, your attention and your awareness and your understanding to go a little more that direction. But there's a lot that comes with it that's positive.
Yes. No, I mean, I hope I haven't just overemphasized the challenges of integration.
Well, it's good to be aware of the challenges. I mean, I remember that those statistics struck me, and it makes sense because I have psychic reality that not everyone shares. That's how I would word it. And, you know, Carl Jung really talked about psychic reality, and he defined a lot of different mysteries and how they related to consciousness and how very real that is. But I feel in a highly technological world, in a highly materialistic world that we're in, that, you know, I could be surrounded by people that literally just can't handle that notion. And that would be awkward. That would be hard.
I think you're right. I mean, I think the modern world feels foreign to those of us who have had these experiences. It's like, why do you live that way? Like, why do we do what we do? I mean, it sounds judgmental, but I often see things. It's like, really, you want to sit looking at a screen on a small telephone for a long period of time, when if you just put it down and looked around at the beauty of nature, there's so much to breathe in, to observe, to be moved by, to wonder about.
So it seems to be a moment we're having. Well, you know, there's so much I would love to discuss more with you. I mean, this is so fascinating to me, and you are such a fountain of incredible information. But a couple things. I wanted to mention your book, At Heaven's Door, and what a resource that is. So I really highly recommend it to people. Your website, I think, has a lot of great information for people to go to if they have questions or if they're curious. Tonight, there is a group that I may join if I can, and it's a shared death experience group. So you have a lot of resources for people.
Thank you so much for, you know, telling your viewers about this, because, yeah, we have a lot of resources on the website. And one of the programs that we've started because when we do interviews and we do, you know, like I said, we've done 400 or 500 interviews and deep on experiences, 2 hours. We ask all these questions about what was your experience about? What's the impact of it? What, how's it changed your beliefs? You know, da, 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 all that. But we found that people were wanting venues to connect with other people who had these experiences. So we started the Share a Death Experience Sharing Group. It's SDE Sharing Group. We started with one about, I don't know, 6 to 8 months ago. And we'd started at 5 o'clock Pacific time, which is okay for people on the East Coast. But then we started getting calls from people, you know, inquiries from people in Europe and other parts of the world saying, hey, I love this group, but I can't participate in the middle of the night. So we started another group. And now we have between, I don't know, between 40 and 100 people showing up at 2 groups a month that you can go as much as you want. They're on Wednesdays. And one's at noon Pacific time. So even if you're in Europe, that's about 8 or 9 p.m. Anyway, we select some of our shared death experiencers to share their story. They take 15, 20 minutes to tell their story. I actually don't facilitate these. I mean, I did in the past, but we have our researchers do this. But the researchers are knowledgeable. I'm on every now and then. But it's a great way to connect. You'll hear the questions from people are just lovely. You know, and people will be comparing and contrasting their experiences. But it's really a way to step into a field where if you've had these experiences, you really get validation and deeper understanding for your experience. Because when you hear someone saying, I had that too. And I know when you explain it that way, it's like, oh, I never thought about that. So yes, please come. There's no cost. It's just, you know, an offering we do.
Well, it seems to me also that the more you provide a space to come connect around this, the more likely you're going to hear more people share that, oh yeah, I'm aware of this. I didn't know what to do with this, but you know, maybe I can go and make sense of it. Well, before we close, I was thinking, what would be some key takeaways that you would really love listeners who may have no experience of this, a little thoughts about this, or at any level, what would you really love us to know or think about?
Yes, thank you. You know, I think the most important thing to realize about our own relationship to death and dying is that in our culture, we don't get much preparation. That is really important, is that most of us say, oh, I know I'm going to die at some point, or my mom's going to die at some point, but we'll deal with it when we get there. Well, death doesn't come on the schedule that you anticipate or want. And so I would encourage people to get informed about what happens around death and dying. And I thank you for bringing up my book, At Heaven's Door. I think I even have one right here. You know, this is it. And, you know, what I really tried to do in this book was share 28 stories of normal people having extraordinary mystical experience at the time of death around a loved one. And the stories talk about mothers who have either in utero deaths of their babies or, you know, a month later they die stillbirth, you know, or they have to take them off of life support when they're young. And so I start with that because that really gets people attention about, oh my gosh, these women are having these types of experiences. And they're like tragic. But when you hear them talk about them, they're like, wait a minute, it was the biggest gift of their life. And so we go on and cover just about every relationship that you can have to a loved one and their particular shared death experience. But, you know, and there are other books out there for sure, or there's other readings, other ways to get informed. But really make a commitment to yourself to become conscious about what happens around death and dying and how you can prepare for it. You know, we have programs on our website that are self-study about these types of spiritual experiences. That's one way, but there's a lot of different ways. And have conversations with your loved ones. Like, what do you think happens really when we die? And then what do you want for end of life? Like, do you want to be surrounded by loved ones, or do you want just me or just your family? Or do you know, what do you want? And how are you going to make this possible? I mean, still to this day, only about 30% of people in Santa Barbara County, I think I'm about right, I won't be off by more than a couple percent, have advanced care directives in the form of My Care or Five Wishes. So, you know, if you don't have that prepared, then as we always say, if you haven't asked your loved ones or informed your loved ones and discussed it with them about the path you want at the end of life and death around it, then I can assure you, you will get the path you don't want, which tends to be full court press if you happen to have a trauma situation. Because, you know, the doctors are good. You go into an ER with a heart attack or a stroke or car accident, you know, they're looking around like, does this one have an advanced care directives? You know, if you've got them, like, okay, he's got a DNR, do not resuscitate. Okay, you guys, we got that. If not, you've got ER doctors saying, oh my God, this guy doesn't have a DNR. That means we're going to have to do CPR. And if he survives this, I'm more worried about him surviving it because he's going to have a lifelong experience of really debilitating injuries that will alter his life significantly. So, you know, I don't mean to scare people, but it's worthy of the scare. Have the conversations, get ready. End of life will come when you most likely least expect it. So do the work now.
It's funny you say least expected. My mom was about almost 92. It was like, what? Oh my God. In a way, it was unexpected. I experienced it that way. Well, thank you for doing the brave work, the brilliant, interesting, brave work, William. I just so appreciate you. And you've certainly helped me immeasurably with my own life and with my folks. And hopefully a lot more people will come to this work with what you've provided. And I know there's a film maybe coming and more. So keep, you know, I'm going to tell listeners to keep your eye on William Peters.
And really have them come to our website if they're interested, because it's not just me. I mean, I have a, you know, I started the organization, but now we have researchers, you know, who are from all over the world. I mean, and they're adding their own insight into this. And so you'll see, you go to sharedcrossing.com, you'll see, and we're going to be revamping the website in the next few months. So if you look at, oh, you know what they should go to? Go to the story library, where you can hear shared death experiences from experiencers. And we have a library where we have videos. We always videotape our interviews. And so we take those videos and then we edit them. It takes a lot of work to get them into, you know, 5 to 6 minutes. And then you can hear them tell their stories. And it's, you're just like, wow. So they'll see very normal people having extraordinary experiences and life-changing. So that's a good way to learn more about the shared death experiences.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you. And we'll see you soon.
Oh, well, thank you. I really enjoyed being a guest with you here today in our conversation, Stacey.
For tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable.